Okay, so we're going to begin now. Again, I apologize. Okay, so today's topic is so. First of all, much of my research for today's topic comes from an article by Tzvi Zohar. He's a professor at Bar Ilan University, entitled "Traditional Flexibility and Modern Strictness: Two Halachic Positions on Women's Suffrage." An article by Rav Yoel Ben Nun. And from the Gush in Tradition Journal, Rav Cook's Public Position on Women Voting, and English translations by Tzvi Zohar of two public letters by Rabbi Avram HaKohen Cook and the response of Rabbi Tzion Uziel on women's suffrage and representation. And we will study much of that today. Now, until the 20th century, the Jewish tradition did not recognize the right of women to be partners in the political process. In this respect, Jewish tradition was no different than what was customary in surrounding cultures. So for example, just give you this date here, between 1917 and 1925, one of the major cultural and political controversies that swept through Europe and America was this question of women's suffrage, both in terms of two different issues. Number one is, can women be voted into office? And are women allowed to vote? In 1917, only Finland, Norway, Denmark, Iceland, and Russia had granted the women the right to vote. So when this issue comes up,
you have to note that the very small universe, very few countries had parliaments that had any voting. It wasn't like every country had a congress or parliament going back hundreds of years and didn't allow them to vote.
Well, these countries that I mentioned granted the women the right to vote. Well, some of them did. Well, we'll see. By 1925, all of them, I'm talking about the North European countries, many of them did have rights to vote, but not rights to vote to women. So in 1917, you had very few countries allowed the women the right to vote. In 1925, all of the Northern European countries, like Britain, Ireland, Luxembourg, Austria, Germany, Sweden, the Netherlands, Czechoslovakia, and Poland, all granted women the right to vote. America granted the right in 1920, with the 19th Amendment to the Constitution. However, there is no country in the Mediterranean basin, Spain, France, Italy, Albania, Yugoslavia, Turkey, and Greece, Asia, Africa, the Middle East, none of these countries recognize women's suffrage. So Palestine was located near the non-women suffrage countries. So they are like, if they look what's going on near them, women aren't given the right to vote. And they are faced with this issue in 1917. In 1917, what happens? The Balfour Declaration asserted that the British government supports the establishment of a national home for the Jewish people in Palestine. And in a new yeshuv now needs to elect a political party, a political entity at least, to represent it to deal with Great Britain. Because 1917, they said you can have a Jewish state. It's obviously going to be a number of years before that happens. But now we need to elect people to deal with Great Britain. So in June of 1918, the second constitutive assembly, which would determine who would represent the Jewish community in Eretz Yisrael, passed the resolution that accorded women full suffrage. The only condition is you have to be at least 25 years old for anyone, both men and women. Now, so they made that rule. In December of 1918, a third assembly convened, and the representatives of the Ashkenazi Old Yeshuv stated that while they are opposed to this, the group would not resist active suffrage for women. In other words, women cannot be elected officers, but they cannot. In other words, they would resist active suffrage, and they could not. They would allow women to vote, but they said women cannot be elected. These are the old yeshuv, the old Ashkenazi yeshuv. Now, the assembly was not sympathetic to this position, and it decided to grant women both forms of suffrage. You know, the rabbis thought, or the old yeshuv thought, you know, we're going to set the tone, we're going to tell them what we think is correct, but they didn't listen, the new yeshuv didn't listen. Now, during the next few months, this issue was hotly debated within the Ashkenazic old yeshuv. In March of 1919, Ashkenazic rabbis and communal leaders in Yerushalayim pronounced that any form of women's suffrage was halachically forbidden. Now, most Sephardi rabbis did not join in this prohibition. So the question is, what would be with the Mizrahi party in Israel? So the Mizrahi party was divided on this issue, and they convinced the General Assembly to postpone national elections until October of 1919. And Mizrahi scheduled a convention in Yerushalayim in September. So again, they're going to say, let's postpone elections until October. In September, we're going to discuss this issue. Because Mizrahi, right, they're traditional, they're religious, but they're also modern, forward-thinking people. And they said, we're going to discuss this. Many members of the Mizrahi party who supported women's suffrage found themselves in direct opposition to those who supported the Jerusalem Ashkenazi rabbinate. So what are they supposed to do? Who are they turned to? They're going to turn to their hero, their leader, Rav Kook. Right? Rav Kook was the one who gave the heter for the heter Bechira. He allowed people to essentially allow crops to grow in Eretz Yisrael. And he was a very well-respected top leader. So the Mizrahi party basically said, we're going to go now to Rav Kook. And he was a newly installed chief Ashkenazi rabbi of Yerushalayim. And he could decide the issue for us. They assumed that just like he was supportive of the Heter Mechira, then he would be supportive of women's suffrage as well. Rav Kook was born in 1865. He was a mystic, he was a halachist, he was a poet, and he was a public figure. And he was born and educated in Eastern Europe. He was an outspoken supporter of the Zionist enterprise, which he saw in a messianic light. He was invited in 1904 to become the chief rabbi of Jaffa. In 1918, he became the chief Ashkenazi rabbi of Yerushalayim. And from 1921 until his death, he was the Ashkenazi chief rabbi of Eretz Yisrael. So again, this is a year after he becomes the Ashkenazi chief rabbi of Yerushalayim. And you have to understand, the old Yishuv, the old guard, who was very opposed to women getting involved in the political process, they were mostly in Yerushalayim. So here they're going to go to the Ashkenazi chief rabbi of Yerushalayim, and he's going to support their position. So, again, they viewed him as an ideal rabbi, as someone who was open to modernity and change. So a rabbinic forum is convened to discuss the issue of women's suffrage, and Rav Kook was included in the forum, and to the shock of many, he issued the following letter. He was opposed to women's suffrage in passionate and unequivocal terms. He asserted that the opposition to women in public life was not merely personal, but the unanimous voice of all Jewish culture and halacha. So Mizrahi tried to avert the impending crisis by obtaining another postponement of the elections. In March of 1920, the World Executive Mizrahi supported the upcoming elections as proposed, and this support implied an endorsement of women's suffrage. Rav Kook then, when he found out about this, he reacted with a second public letter articulating an opposition even stronger than the first. He asserted, we'll read this soon, he asserted that participation in this election constituted betrayal against the Jewish tradition and law, and he supported a boycott by religious Jews of the elections unless women were barred from electoral office. Okay, and from the electoral process. Meanwhile, while this was going on, Rabbi Tzion Meir Chai Uziel, the chief Sephardic rabbi of Yafo, composed a responsum on this issue in 1920. Who was Rav Uziel? Rav Uziel was born in 1880 in the old city of Yerushalayim to an illustrious Sephardic family, and he served as the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv Yafo until 1939, when he was appointed and served as the Rishon LeZion, the chief Sephardic rabbi of Palestine and Eretz Israel until his death. He is the author of a 6-volume responses series entitled Mishpatei Uziel. So again, he's no slouch. He's not a halachic, minor leaguer. He is a major player, certainly in the Sephardi scene in Eretz Yisrael. In his responsum, He argues strongly for women's suffrage for religious, moral, and political grounds. Out of respect for Rav Kook, he never identified Rav Kook by name, but it is clear that much of his responsum is a point-by-point rebuttal of Rav Kook's arguments in Rav Kook's two letters. It should be noted, by the way, that there was a third position. Again, Rav Ben Zion Uziel said that they can vote and they can be voted in. Rav Kook said neither. And of course, there's an in-between position, which is that, was offered by Rav David Zvi Hoffman, who was a leading German rabbi who lived from 1843 to 1921. He felt they could vote, but they could not be elected. He held that they may not hold public office based on the prohibition of Sarara, that the Rambam rules, like Rambam rules and extends the Sifri, the Torah says, Som Tassim Alecha. Yeah, I'm gonna explain this right now. Yes. So the Torah says, Som Tassim Alecha Melech. The Torah says you should place upon yourself a king. The Sifri writes, that's a midrash of the Chazal of rabbis, says a king but not a queen. And the Rambam extended this to all forms of Sarara, all forms of public, all positions of public authority, that only men should be appointed. In any case, this was an in-between view, and he wrote this view in the Yeshurun Journal in 1919. But for purposes of our discussion today, I would like to focus on the two extreme positions, Rav Kook's position and Rav Uziel's position. So let's first turn to Rav Kook's position. Upon what was his opposition to women's suffrage based? So let's read the two letters here. Okay, I have here the handout. I try to make it on one page. This unfortunately made it to two pages, but it's good stuff. So we're going to read Rav Kook's two letters. Okay, the first letter, remember, this was there were two letters. The first letter was when they first asked him to take a position. The second letter is after the Mizrahi party already voted, despite Rav Kook, to adopt the assembly's general acceptance of their proposals, which would include women voting. So the first letter is dated September 1919. An open letter to the Honorable Committee of the Mizrahi Association. I was honored to receive your request. They expressed my opinion concerning the pending question of electing women to the Assembly of the Representatives of Jews of the Land of Israel. Despite my not being worthy of being approached, I consider that circumstances require that I expound my opinion on this matter with greatest possible brevity. So, let me get to the point. Seems to me that the issue can be analyzed under three headings. Regarding the law, the din, whether the matter is permitted or forbidden. Regarding the general good, whether good for Israel will result from an affirmative answer or from a negative one. And number three, regarding the ideal, whether our moral consciousness opposes the prospect or supports it. Again, I didn't summarize you. I gave you just different pieces, what I think are important pieces from each letter. If you want, I can send you the full letter after the class. So he writes, regarding the law, I have nothing to add to the words of the rabbis who came before me. In the Torah, in the prophets, and in the writings, in the halacha and the agada, we hear a single voice, that the duty of fixed public service falls upon men, for it is a man's manner to dominate and not a woman's manner to dominate. This is a statement from Yevamos, in Gemara, Daf Samechei Amud Beis, and that roles of office, judgment, and of testimony are not for her, for, what's the Hebrew phrase for this? All her honor is within. Right? This is from Tehillim. Notice, by the way, he's citing, I would say to be very precise, he's citing agadic positions. In other words, these aren't rulings. These are statements. These are sort of Talmudic statements or statements from Tehillim, which indicate a certain philosophy as he interprets it. Striving to prevent the mixing of sexes and gatherings is a theme that runs through the entire Torah. Thus, any innovation in public leadership that necessarily brings about mixing of the sexes is in a multitude, in the same group or gathering, in the routine course of the people's life, is certainly against the law. Finally, as to the ideal, deeply imprinted in our soul is the ideal of being unblemished by any sin. Only Israel's return to its land, to its setting and its kingdom, and to its Holy Spirit, its prophecy and its temple will eventually bring into the world that sublime light for which all noble souls of all humanity yearn. And this will surely come about only through maintaining our true character in accordance with all the laws and ordinances by which the Torah instructs us in the ways of life, of exalted glory, of supreme freedom, and of redemption. This is my inner conviction, which I convey to you, my beloved brothers, in the integrity of my heart, awaiting prompt liberation with God's blessing from Zion and Jerusalem. Respectfully, Abraham Isaac HaKohen Cook. Before we analyze this letter, I just want to read his second letter, which is written a few months later in April. And there he says, to the many who have asked about the participation of women in the election of the Constitutive Assembly, because Mayor Mizrahi already said there that they are accepting this proposal, your weighty query regarding the election of women to the Assembly of the Jews of the Land of Israel is again an issue, even though I have already expressed my opinion on this matter in general in my open letter to the Mizrahi Association. As for my own opinion, as a matter of theory, however, I would like to add some clarification to what I said in the foregoing open letter. As then, I must say now that the rabbis who declared the legal prohibition drew their opinion from the source of the one voice we hear from the Torah, from the prophets, and from Scripture, from the Halacha, from the Agada, that teaches us that the spirit of the whole nation in its essence and purity opposes this modern innovation. It teaches as well that if we bend ourselves specifically to the novel Irish morality, because Ireland just granted at that point women's suffrage, so that's why he's referencing Irish morality, we thereby commit an act of betrayal to our own morality, the morality of Judaism. Such an act stifles the spirit of the nation and lowers to the ground the fortress of national revival. If we are not prophets, we are the sons of prophets, and we must call out in a great voice to all our brothers who at present desire the strengthening of our revival, urging them to guard their spirits and not to feed us this unripe fruit whose adverse effects we will necessarily greatly regret. We believe our outlook on the life of society is more delicate and pure than of the other civilized nations in general. He says we're different. Our family is sacred to us in a much deeper way than it is to all the modern world. And that is this is the basis of the happiness and dignity of the women of Israel. In other nations, the family is not the foundation of the nation, nor is it as stable and deep as it is amidst us. For this reason, they are not so taken aback by the cracks in family life, and the consequences of those breaks will not cause such harm to their national life. The psychological basis for calling for public participation elections by the name of women's rights arises fundamentally from the unhappy position of the mass of women amidst these nations. If their family situation had been as peaceful and dignified as it is generally in Israel, the women themselves, as well as men of science, morality, and high ideals, would not demand what they call rights or suffrage for women in the common fashion, a step that might spoil domestic tranquility and ultimately lead to great deterioration of political and national life in general. He's saying the other nations. Basically, he's claiming that the Jewish family life is much better. And basically, we are simply want to do this because the other nations want to do this. But out of their desperation and bitterness, the result of male coarseness that spoils family life, the women of other nations thought to receive through some public empowerment help in ameliorating their wretched situation at home, without regard to the further breaches made thereby, since those breaches are so numerous. We have not descended and shall not descend to such a state and will not want to see our sisters in such a low state. The home for us remains a dwelling place of holiness, and we dare not obliterate the splendor of our sisters' lives and embitter them through exposure to the din of opinions and disputation that are characteristic of electoral matters and political questions. The family is for us the foundation of the nation. The house of Yaakov, right, Beis Yaakov, which alludes to women, will build the people of Israel. We prepare the building of the nation in a manner consistent with the nature of our psyche. We are always prepared to declare the moral obligation of listening to women's opinions throughout the House of Israel, including those with reference to general social and political questions. But the accepted opinion must come specifically from the home, from the family and its holders. And the one whose duty it is to bring it into the public domain is the man, the father of the family, on whom is placed the obligation of making known the family opinion. When we demand of the woman that she go out into the political domain and become entangled in expressing her opinion on electoral and political questions in general, then one of two things will result. Either she will learn through this flattery to flatter the man and to cast her vote according to his, not according to her conscience, thereby spoiling her morality and inner freedom, or raging differences of opinion will destroy domestic tranquility, shalom bayis. and the rifts in the family will fracture the nation. At the same time, we lower our collective dignity in the eyes of the nations by showing the world that we have no original political system stemming from the content of our own spirit, which is revealed through our teachings and holy traditions. These are for us not only symbolic matters, but embody real life values. Instead, we act at the beginning of our first step towards political life as lesser disciples of contemporary civilized people who themselves still stand very confused concerning their difficult life issues, especially with regard to their spiritual and moral values in general, and with respect to this difficult problem of home and state in particular. This, as stated, is the presentation of my theoretical opinion. As a practical decision, we now need the presentation of opinion and the decision of the gathering of our rabbis in the land of Israel, which I hope that our best forces will help to actualize. This is what I think, but all the rabbis have to agree, saying. I hope as well that our honorable public activists and organizers of the Constitutive Assembly will also, on their end, support removing the obstacle barring the greater majority of the Jewish public in the land of Israel from participating in the national gathering of elections. In that way, we will be able to announce openly to all of Israel and to all of the world the total consensus of the Constitutive Assembly, which will truly be representative of the Israeli public in the land of Israel, which in certain respects is the national representative of the whole nation. Now, she said, this is my opinion, but I want us to come together. And this good hope shall come to pass, etc., etc. So essentially, just to summarize, he basically says the following. Rav Kook says, right, he's not just a modern thinker, is he? Okay, and at least in this regard. He's not so progressive in this regard. So he says, based on the Gemara in Yevamos, that it is a man's manner to dominate and not a woman's manner to dominate. The role of public office is in a man and not a woman's domain. He also believed that the act of voting leads to the mixing of genders in the public sphere, which for him is forbidden. He felt that his position reflected Jewish morality and women's suffrage, which run contrary to this ideal. He argued that the spirit of the whole nation, its essence and purity, opposes this modern innovation. He felt that women's suffrage would negatively impact Jewish family, and the role of the Jewish woman is in the home, and changing that would negatively impact Shalom Bayis because of division regarding political views. And there would be nothing to talk about at the Shabbos table. He also felt that keeping the woman's place outside the sphere of public life is necessary to protect their position, their delicacy and modesty. He believes that his position attests to greater respect for women, which is obviously inconsistent with modern society today. Now, Rav Yoel ben Nun wrote an article about this topic in which he argued that Rav Kook understood that the issue of women's suffrage was more. It was more than simply about allowing women to vote or to be elected. He thought it mounted to a change in the nature of society. During World War I, Rav Kook lived in Switzerland. Right? He traveled to Switzerland. World War I breaks out. He's stuck there for most of World War I. So he lives there for 2 years, where women did not have a right to vote. And this demonstrated to Rav Kook that you can have a modern society without this innovation, which he perceived as dangerous. Not only did he think it was a halachic problem, but he also thought that it would lead to a breakdown of the traditional family structure. So what was Rav Uziel's response? So we're going to see in Rav Uziel's response, he's not going to mention Rav Kook's name, but he's going to address each of these points and how he would respond to them. Okay, so let's read, and we can see essentially he makes 3 points. So he wrote a tshuva, right? This is dated 1920. And again, he doesn't mention Rav Kook by name, but he's clearly responding to his arguments. And the title of this is in Mishpatei Uziel, number 44. It's a responsum. I wrote this responsum originally to clarify this halakha for myself, not wishing to publicize and teach this responsum and this halakha for implementation. However, now since the question has been resolved by itself, I deem it good to publicize it for the purposes of enhancing Torah. They already made a decision, so he was just trying to respond essentially to Rav Kook. So number one, the women's right to vote. This issue became a central controversy in Eretz Yisrael, and the whole land of Israel rocked with the debate. Posters and warnings, pamphlets and newspaper articles appeared anew every morning, absolutely prohibiting women's participation in elections. You know, like those, they put them up, you know, and what are they called? Paschkevilim or something. Kol Koretz, whatever. They come out these papers. And they're protesting anyone. So they were probably putting out papers and saying, it's usur, it's forbidden. It's forbidden to vote. Some based their argument on Torah law, some on the need to preserve the boundaries of modesty and morals, and others on the wish to ensure the peace of the family home. All leaned upon the saying, the new is prohibited by the Torah, Chadash Asur Min HaTorah. Right? That was a famous statement by whom? Who made this statement famous? You remember? It's in the Chassam Sofer, right? In the response to the Reform movement. So some people just said, we're going to reform all of Judaism. Right? Rav Hirsch, for example, takes a middle position. He does certain innovations. He gives his drasha in the vernacular. He has a choir, but not an organ. He innovates a little bit. And Chassam Sofer says, Chadash Asur Min HaTorah, you cannot innovate anything new. And Rabbi Tzion Uziel is saying that some people are basically taking this position. I don't think it's Rav Kook's position. Rav Kook is willing to innovate where he feels that it's appropriate to innovate. He didn't feel it's appropriate to innovate here. But there are those, obviously, from the old yeshuv, quote-unquote, the more charei, more yeshivish camp, that clearly said, Chadash Asur Min HaTorah. This issue can be subdivided into two headings, the right to vote and the right to be elected. Regarding the first, we find no clear ground to prohibit this. And it is inconceivable that women should be denied this personal right. For in these elections, we elevate leaders upon us and empower our representatives to speak in our name, to organize the matters of our yeshuv, and to levy taxes on our property. The women, whether directly or indirectly, accept the authority of these representatives and obey their public and national directives and laws. How could then one simultaneously pull the rope from both ends, lay upon them the duty to obey those elected by the people, yet deny them the right to vote on the elections? If they're going to be subject to them, they should be able to vote. Probably Rav Kook would say, you'll talk about it at home and then you'll decide together, which obviously Rav Uziel is saying that's not the reality. He's saying that's not the reality. Okay. Now, in some respects, like Rav Kook, I think, and this is nothing, I think Rav Kook in some respects, and also I think in how he dealt with the idea of sort of dealing with the non-religious, I think he sometimes lived in a very idealized world of what he felt Judaism should look like, and perhaps, you know, that may, and Rav Uziel saying, well, this is the reality.
Right. Only arrived at a certain time for women, because in reality they were mostly opposed.
Right.
So, but now this is changing. Right. The external world is changing, and they're becoming more educated.
Right. Again, so I'm wondering if it was because of that. I mean, partially that, but I think it was also like in all these other countries, this was the talk of the town. And listen, if you're a modern, if you're a Jew in the modern world, you look at what's going on in the world, and you accept or you reject. In other words, if you're more right wing, then you're just going to. You're not going to really care unless it's forced upon you here. So right. So they're looking around. They're saying the other country. And certainly the secular, the non-Orthodox Jews, or Israelis, or the Palestinians, Jews in Eretz Yisrael are looking around and they're saying, "Look what's going on. We want to do this as well." So let's continue. So he says that if anyone should tell us that women should be excluded from the voting because their minds are flighty, nashim datin kalos, and they know not how to choose who is worthy of leading the people, we reply, then let us exclude from the electorate those men who are flighty minds. Okay. However, reality confronts us clearly with the fact that both in the past and in our times, women are equal to men in knowledge and wisdom, dealing in commerce and trade and conducting all personal matters in the best possible way. Has it ever been known that a guardian is appointed to conduct the affairs of an adult woman against her will? The meaning of our rabbi's statement, Datan Kalos, is entirely different. Indeed, the Talmud itself states that the woman who asked the question was a wise person. A wise person, a wise woman posed this question to Rabbi Eliezer. And our rabbis expressly stated, and God constructed the rib. This teaches us the more insight was granted to women, to the woman. But perhaps this should be prohibited because of licentiousness. But what licentiousness can there be in this, that each person goes to the poll and enters a voting slip? If we start considering such activities as licentious, no creature would be able to survive. Women and men would be prohibited from walking in the street or from entering a shop together. It would be forbidden to negotiate in commerce with a woman lest this encourage closeness and lead to licentiousness. Such ideas have never been suggested by anyone. Maybe not yet. Yeah, you have a question?
So, this seems a critical point to make, that it was the Eastern European rabbis who were long exposed to the reform, and then the later 19th century the radicals, the socialists of the religious Jews, who moved now against any change, they saw from that perspective. But it was the Sephardim who had no experience with reform or any change. They were open to change because they weren't exposed to what was going on. They had a much different experience. So I think that's why they
were
likely to open to some change.
Yeah, I think it's a great point. By the way, I said Sephardi, I mean Sephardi rabbis.
When
I say rabbis, because now it's the Mizrahi party. The Mizrahi party, Sephardi were generally more open in general because maybe they didn't get exposed to the assimilation. That's what I was guessing. It's a very good point. I think Sephardi rabbis in general have generally been more, I'm not talking about recent, I'm saying back then, some of the Sephardi rabbis have generally maybe been more open than, let's say, some of the Ashkenazi rabbis who lived in the Ashkenazi yeshivas. They tend to have been more, you know, fighting these battles.
But generally speaking, the Sephardi women have a much less of a right to decide, to speak.
So it could be their culture, but the rabbi, in terms of fear, I guess what I was suggesting, I think there's something to what he's saying. In terms of fear of this innovation is going to lead to licentiousness, so this is like a reform we're doing to the other nations and that kind of issue. So that might be something more that's on the minds of the Ashkenazi rabbi. I think it's a very good point to think about. So then he says the second issue. Is whether a woman can be elected to. So what he says. So the first point again is just to summarize. He says the women are given greater insight. It has never been suggested that public activities involving men and women should be prohibited. And he also makes a point. I don't think I have it here, but he writes also that shalom bias is an issue. So then you should only have one vote per household. Because what if, God forbid, an adult son votes against what his father says? In other words, people have different opinions. It is what it is. Next issue he deals with is, may women be elected? So the second issue is whether a woman can be elected to public office. Now, it seems prima facie that we have come up against an explicit prohibition. For in the Sifrei, it is written, thou shalt appoint, and if he dies, another is appointed instead. Som tasim. Melech v'lo malkah, king and not a queen. For this source, Maimonides, the Rambam, derived the rule. So a woman may not be appointed to the throne, as it is written, a king and not a queen. And likewise, all public appointments, that's a Hebrew word, with srara in Israel, are to be made from amongst the men and not the women. Therefore, a woman should not be appointed as head of a community. Now, according to one explanation offered by Tosfos, that Devorah was a judge in virtue of her having been accepted by the public, we learn that there is no prohibition against appointing a woman to public office, and that she may be appointed in case of need, but that it's considered an insult to the community that they can find no one to judge them except a female. Again, we're talking.
It's not the fact that she was a female.
No, but that there were no men. There were no men. Again, we're talking about back then in the days of Shoaf. My point is, this. They're talking about in biblical times where basically, the men were expected to lead in all society and not women. So that's why it was viewed there. It is clear then that the text of the Sifrei is to be explained accordingly. A queen should not be appointed over Israel by a Beit Din appointment, an official appointment, because of the dignity of the public, because it signals that there's no man who's capable, which is embarrassing. Therefore, a person or persons may with full right vote for her, and by virtue of her voter support, she may join the representative body. And he goes on to say, and if one's heart still hesitates, and it should be so, rather than to reject outright the Sifrei of the Maimonides' position by sharp conjectures and purely logical operations and analyses without any positive indication of the existence of an alternate halakhic position, then women's eligibility to be elected, let's say you still want the Rambam, because Tosos disagrees, but let's say you want to follow the Rambam. Women's eligibility to public office can be halachically justified on other grounds. The prohibition relates only to appointment made by a Sanhedrin, but in our situation, the issue is not one of appointment, but one of acceptance. Through the election process,
the majority of the public expresses its acceptance of and confidence in certain persons as their representatives and designate them to be their agents in supervising all public affairs. In other words, what he's saying is that he argues that the prohibition only applies as a formal law, just like a king and a queen, a formal law. It only applies to appointment by the Beit Din, but this would not apply to public elections. Furthermore, he argues, I don't think I wrote it here, but he also argues something what's called lo ra'inu eido raya. The absence of proof is no proof. What Rav Kook also argued was that we see for hundreds of years, right, women did not have the right to vote. Women were not involved in public office. But he's saying the absence of proof is not a proof. Just because there haven't been female elected politicians in Jewish history, with the possible exception of Devorah, is not a proof that it shouldn't be done. And he proves that the position offered by the Sifrei is not necessarily accepted as definitive halacha by some Rishonim, like Tosfos. He believes that Devorah was accepted as a judge, not through appointment by Beis Din, but by acceptance of the public. And then he makes this final point in letter D regarding law and morality. He writes, logic dictates that in no serious assembly or worthy discussion is there licentiousness. Daily, men meet and negotiate with women in commercial transactions, and yet all is peace and quiet. Even those inclined to sexual licentiousness will not contemplate the forbidden while seriously transacting business. A rabbi did not say, Al tarba sicha ima isha, do not engage in much conversation with a woman, this is from Mishnah Avos, except as regard to idle, needless chatter, for that sort of conversation leads to sin. But not so debate over important communal issues. Meeting in the same enclosed area for the sake of public service, which is tantamount to service of the divine, does not habituate people to sin or cause levity. For all Jews, men and women alike are holy and not suspected of violating conventions of modesty or morality. His final point regarding law and morality is that even though you have this Mishnah and Avos, don't engage in much conversation with a woman, that only pertains to idle chatter and not to a public debate over communal matters. He dismisses the claims that certain statements of Chazal prohibited men and women to work together for common good will lead to licentiousness. Doing so do not threaten morality and family life. What immorality could ensue from allowing women to go to the ballot box to register their votes. Women, like men, were created B'Tzelem Elohim in God's image, and they had a basic right to be able to vote. And not only was there no prohibition to letting them vote, but depriving them would be unjust and would cause upon them humiliation and pain. He concludes, a woman has an absolute right to participation in elections so that she be bound by the collective obligation to obey the elected officials who govern the nation. And a woman may also be elected to public office by the consent and ordinance of the community. It seems, when you compare these two two letters by Rav Kook and the response by Rav Uziel, seems that Rav Kook approaches this issue not only on pure halacha, but also as to what he believes is good for Israel and what is the moral ideal, whereas Rav Uziel is focused on pure halacha, what is and what is not permitted, and that governs what is good for Israel and what is the moral ideal. Some have argued that Rav Kook took a chadash min asr min haTorah approach. Innovation is forbidden or is generally frowned upon absent exigent circumstances, whereas Rav Uziel rejects the opinion that innovation was that innovation necessarily evil. As I point out to you, it's not clear to me that's consistent with other positions by Rav Kook. It seems to me that Rav Kook viewed certain statements by the Talmud regarding women as absolute and eternal, whereas Rav Uziel viewed them as a reflection of society and culture. That's always the question when it comes to women's issues, whether we're talking about 100 years ago or we're talking about today, are certain statements by Chazal, which statements by Chazal, by our sages about women, are they considered absolute and eternal, or which reflect the culture and society of the time and are subject to change? For example, Nashim Datan Kalos, women are weak-minded, or it's the nature of a man and not a woman to conquer. Additionally, Rav Uziel values the concept of rights probably more than Rav Kook.
Rav Kook would not approve of granting rights if doing so would undermine the well-being of those who are granted those rights. Now, when you think about values, like, we need rights. We need rights. Rights is the most basic value. Rav Kook may not necessarily feel that granting someone the right to do a certain thing is good if it undermines, you know, greater values. At the same time, Rav Kook understood that the right of women's suffrage was a critical issue for many Jews, and therefore, Rav Kook proposed that there be two elected bodies. One for the general public, which would include women, and one for the Orthodox public, which would not include women and would remain faithful to the idea of the traditional family. All major decisions involving the nation as a whole would have to be adopted by both parties, the Senate and the Congress. Okay, both have. Okay? Agudas Yisrael, they made the same proposal. They followed Rav Kook in a lot of issues, except for he believed that the creation of state of a Jewish state is a messianic idea, and they disagreed. Other than that, they agreed on a lot of issues. This idea, though, was rejected as a danger to national unity for obvious reasons. Then Rav Kook suggested two polling stations, one for the wider public and one for Haredim, where only men would vote and their vote counted twice. This proposal was actually adopted for the elections in the summer of 1920. However, the non-Haredi public completely distanced themselves from him on this issue. Even the Orthodox Mizrahi leadership distanced from Rav Kook on this issue. You have to understand, at that time, in many European communities like Vilna, women were already voting. Rav Yehuda Leib Fishman, who was very close to Rav Kook, said, on matters of religious law, we will ask the rabbis. On matters of the marketplace, they should ask us. Okay? The question is this a matter of marketplace or not? Additionally, the compromise did not satisfy the Haredim in any case, and they ended up boycotting the elections. About 40% of the Jerusalem voters did not take part. Now, Rav Yoel ben Nun writes the following comment. He says that many among the general population, Sephardim independent voters, and some Mizrahi supporters, became convinced that Rav Kook and the Haredim were trying to make the country Haredi through this issue, and they voted for the socialist parties, and they maintained their leadership in the country from 1920 to 1977. This is Rav Yoel ben Nun's argument. I'm just going to say, I'm not sure if I agree or not, but it's an interesting argument. He argues that the religious and the Haredim lost significant political power, and the moderate Haredim of Jerusalem who supported Rav Kook could not withstand the pressure of Agudat Yisrael, who felt that they should not be involved in these elections because of the women's suffrage issue. This controversy highlights the question of innovation with respect to the role of women, and it also highlights the question of compromise and influence. How much should the religious compromise, if failure to do so, will hinder their ability to influence society at large? Is Rav Yoel ben Nun right? Did the religious community cede its influence because of this hardline stance in the 1920s, and which resulted in perhaps the boycotting of many religious individuals from voting, and also the move to the socialist parties, which may have shaped the future Jewish state? Could the religious have been far more influential if Rav Kook would have sacrificed his ideal values on this issue, as he did when it came to the Heter Mechira? We can only guess. And that's it. Again. Okay, I apologize again for my...